You're listening to the Carol Cox Show on 1080 AM K108.
I heard the song of the world's last whale as it rocked in the moonlight and reefed the sail. It'll happen to you also without fail if it happens to me, sang the world's last whale. It was down off Bermuda early last spring, near an underwater mountain where the humpbacks sing. I lowered the microphone about a quarter mile down, switched on the recorder, let the tape spin round. I didn't just hear grunting, I didn't just hear squeaks, I didn't just hear bellows, I didn't just hear shrieks. It was the musical singing and the passionate wail that came from the heart of the world's last whale. Down in the Antarctic, there the harpoons wait, but it's up on land you decide my fate. In London town, there'll be telling the tale if it's life or death for the world's last whale. So here's a little test to see how you feel. Here's a little test for this age of the automobile. If we can save our singers up in the sea, perhaps there's a chance to save you and me. I heard the song of the world's last whale as it rocked in the moonlight and reefed the sail. It happened to you also without fail. If it happens to me, sang the world's last whale.
Good morning and welcome to the Carol Cox Show. We are another beautiful day and nice clouds. Looking over the Pali today, and absolutely beautiful. A little sun will come, and we'll have a little rain, and we'll get on with life. Others are suffering from ice storms and wind storms and tornadoes, but good to be here in Hawaii. Today I have a guest, Dr. Marsha Green, or Professor of Psychobiology at the Albright College in Pennsylvania. And we're going to be bouncing around some of the issues and some of the concerns that many people have been expressing regarding the whale sanctuary here in Hawaii. And a lot of you, as you drive around the island, you see the grand old humpback jump and breach and blow and what have you. But there's a lot of things that are occurring that are having an effect or impacting. And we're going to toss those around. And Dr. Green, are you there?
I'm here.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you. How are you?
I'm fine. I want to thank you for joining me. And hopefully you can help me educate and help the public understand what is going on. We're all aware that there's a sanctuary here, and we all adore the whales and want to protect them. But you have some more insight as to some of the things, the management of the sanctuaries and what have you. And tell me a little about yourself, if you would.
Well, I am a professor, as you said, of psychobiology, and I've been doing research on humpback whales in Hawaii since 1989. I was studying the effects of parasail boats on whales. I studied the effects of engine noise on whales. And in the process of doing that, I noticed that boats and engine noise definitely change the behavior of humpback whales, so I became very interested in acoustic impacts on marine life.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been studying that quite intensely. I travel around the world speaking at various international fora, the United Nations, NATO. And I have been on a set of advisory committee advising Congress on acoustic impacts. But I've always been so closely connected to Hawaii, as I've been coming here since 1985, and I actually, along with Alan Tom and some others, was involved in getting the Hawaiian Humpback Whale Sanctuary established.
Mm-hmm.
I founded a nonprofit in 1995 called the Ocean Mammal Institute, and we've been working pretty consistently since that time to educate people about threats to especially whales and dolphins.
I see we had a little break there.
Yes.
Okay. Anyway, if you would bear with me, I don't know why we're having a little technical. And so tell us about the Hawaiian Humpback Whale Sanctuary, what you know about some of the things, the basic current issues.
Well, I came here January 1st. I teach a course here every January to college students called Field Research on the Hawaiian Humpback Whale. And then I stayed in February to do my own research because I have a sabbatical this semester. And I didn't know this, but when I got here, I learned that the whale sanctuary currently is just beginning to revise its management plan. Technically, the sanctuary is supposed to revise its management plan every 5 years. The last time the sanctuary did that was in 2002, so they're a bit overdue for doing it, but they have started the process. So I, you know, immediately thought, wow, this is a great opportunity to become involved in the revision of the management plan and to help the sanctuary do some things to really protect humpback whales. Because I've been quoted in the past saying that currently the Hawaiian Humpback Whale Sanctuary really does nothing to actually actively protect humpback whales. In other words, it's pretty much a sanctuary in name only and doesn't have any active programs to actually protect whales from some very immediate threats
mm-hmm.
that they're facing. I would say that the most immediate threats include things like ship strikes. Last year, 9 whales were hit by vessels in the sanctuary, with 4 other reports of whales probably hit by vessels, and I think they probably were. So somewhere between 9 and 12 whales were actually struck by boats in the sanctuary last year, and that's, you know, a pretty typical year. It happens pretty frequently. The water quality in the sanctuary is very, very poor. That's a big issue that a lot of people are involved in, on Maui at least. I'm not sure how much people are involved on the other islands, but water quality is a very big issue. In Maui, they are dumping 15 billion gallons a year of wastewater into essentially sanctuary waters. The interesting thing about that is that the Sanctuary Act that established this sanctuary says there will be no dumping of waste in the sanctuary. So that policy has just been basically ignored. And this water quality issue obviously has to be addressed.
Now, on whale strikes, you said 9 last year.
Right.
Now, as a citizen or just a person who's interested in whales and what have you, would I be able to obtain that information as to when and what boat hit it, or is there a public report that is produced by the sanctuary or enforcement? How would the public learn more details of a whale strike?
That's a very good question, Carol. I learned it by emailing Naomi McIntosh, who's the superintendent of the sanctuary.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as I know, there is no public, you know, yearly report of how many whales are struck in the sanctuary.
Mm-hmm.
At this point, if people wanted that information, I would recommend that they call or email Naomi McIntosh, and her email is Naomi.McIntosh, McIntosh, at NOAA, NOAA.gov, G-O-V. And any emails to Naomi, I would highly recommend that people copy Al and Tom on the email because you will get a much faster response.
Mm-hmm.
And that's Al and Tom, A-L-L-E-N dot Tom, T-O-M, at NOAA.gov. Those are two, you know, important emails to get information about the sanctuary.
Now, we are told, I'm assuming it's someone that has told us that it's nine, but it is based or dependent on the captain or the crew of the ship or the ship operator to inform the government of a strike, am I correct?
Yeah, normally that's what would happen, or someone that sees it happen can mm-hmm. also call in. If you have the numbers to call, you can also call in. You can report stranded whales. You can report, you know, injured whales, whales being hit by boats. You can report harassment
yeah.
through NOAA. Yeah. I have those phone numbers here if you want them.
Well, we'll give them out, but I want to focus on the fact when we say nine, we're talking about some of the difficulties or the inadequacies in the management process of the sanctuary, and I want to speak to that more specifically, and then we'll
mm-hmm.
give those numbers out. But just trying to dissect, what then we have to rely on the boat operator or the crew or a citizen who witnesses it. And this is a big ocean, so it's an honor system, correct?
I think you could call it an honor system, yes.
So we shouldn't rest on our laurels if in fact, if we're told nine, and it sounds as though the superintendent or whomever is responsible for that is not aggressively pursuing this and trying to timely get this information. Would it be fair to say that a lot of these so-called strikes or problems that we experience is that we know from the public is that either it's an entanglement or the whale is so badly maimed that it comes near the shore and a fisherman sees it showing propeller or another boater sees it showing propeller strikes. Is that pretty much what they'd be relying on, that type of information?
Well, you're right. Often when a whale is hit by a boat, you can see the literal, you know, cuts of the propeller in their back.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably the most common way you would know a whale was hit by a boat. Although sometimes whales are impaled on the front of a boat and people don't know it.
Right.
That happens a lot with high-speed ferries around the world. They come into port, you know, there could be a, you know, 80-foot whale impaled on the front of the boat and they don't even know it.
Mm-hmm. And so this reporting program would really depend on the integrity of the reporting system and the integrity of the management. And do we see any problems with this, or is there any flaws in this system that you think that you would recommend directly to the superintendent or the management in Washington that we need to do something or change the policy?
Absolutely. I think that ship strikes are obviously an immediate threat to whales in this sanctuary. I don't think it's being addressed by the sanctuary.
Mm-hmm.
As far as I can tell, there's no written plan in the agenda of the management plan revision to address this.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, they haven't written down, okay, this is the one of the things we're going to discuss and address as we revise this management plan.
Mm-hmm.
And this is an issue that, you know, occurs in other sanctuaries as well. It has been addressed by other sanctuaries. It's something that can be addressed. It's not that difficult to do it.
Mm-hmm.
For example, the Stellwagen Bank National Marine Sanctuary off of Cape Cod addresses it by having regulations on speed limits in the sanctuary.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, if you have certain speed limits, the speed limit they have depends on how far away from a whale you are. But, of course, that cuts down on the probability of hitting a whale if you're not going so slow because you're more likely to see it. So I think one of the very important things that this revision in the management plan needs to address is what are we going to do about whales being hit by boats in the sanctuary?
Mm-hmm.
It's critical.
Well, recently I traveled to Lanai, and I was shocked at what I saw in the boat operation. We see these vessels carrying 10, 20, 30 people. They're rigid hull, inflatable types. And I didn't know boats could travel so fast of that size. And you can see the whales right inshore, and they're at the Manelli Bay in those areas.
Absolutely, yes, of course.
Unbelievable at the speed. And I was thinking, you know, that in that area, that was a marine sanctuary. But, again, to allow that and with the presence and the high volume and traffic and the number of whales there, I was a little taken aback by what was allowed and what was permitted. And
well, that the reality is, Carol, there this sanctuary has absolutely no regulations to protect whales. That's you know, my point and why I've been talking to people about this issue. So there are no regulations to protect whales, and you're right, that area between Maui and Lanai, that's the largest part of the sanctuary,
mm-hmm.
And that's where most of the whales are. That's why it is the largest part of the sanctuary, and as I said, there are no regulations to protect whales, and I cannot see in the agenda for, they had a meeting to, you know, begin the revision of the management plan on March 3rd and 4th. And I saw the agenda of that meeting, and in that agenda, there was no plan to discuss any of the things that are immediate threats to the whales in the sanctuary. That's my concern.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely none presented.
No, none presented. Now, in the sanctuary, this has been a long-standing regulation even before the sanctuary was created. The regulation is that you cannot approach a humpback whale any closer than 100 yards. But that's not a sanctuary regulation. That's a regulation that, as I said, was in place long before the sanctuary even existed. It's a federal regulation to protect humpback whales in Hawaii. And so, you know, the sanctuary lists that in their brochure as a regulated activity, but it's not something that the sanctuary instituted. It was in place before the sanctuary existed.
So a lot of my listeners, and like me, I like to have things repeated. So what you're telling me is that though we have a sanctuary, we have no rules in that sanctuary in some of these things to protect the whales, and we have only adopted or incorporated previously existing rules for other sites, and they're really not rules. Is that, am I stating that right?
That is absolutely correct. There are no regulations in this sanctuary to actually protect whales. I mean, what they do is mostly educational programs for children, you know, print brochures, that kind of thing, but they are not addressing and don't have any plans that I can see to address the immediate threats to the humpback whales in this sanctuary, and I think that's what they should be doing in this management plan revision process. They need to begin to discuss these things that actually impact, injure, and can even kill whales. I mean, ship strikes is just one of them.
Right.
There are other threats to whales in the sanctuary that need to be addressed.
And also, getting past the striking and the hitting or the cutting of them, just the mere changing of their behavior, their resting, their feeding, their what have you. What do they have any oversight or regulatory practices to regulate that? Now, I'm not talking about the law enforcement. As you say, the existing laws already exist, and NOAA, for example, does have special agents that respond to these complaints when they are called in. That's separate of the sanctuary, and just yesterday, we saw probably one of the most horrendous cases of harassment that I've witnessed in many, many, many years. And the NOAA officer immediately came out there to see this and took interviews and what have you. But do they have that same kind of setup within the sanctuary, or are they moving toward that? And how long have they been, the sanctuary been in place?
The sanctuary has been in place since, I think it's 1992 it was established.
Okay.
But I don't believe the sanctuary itself has enforcement officers. You're correct. There are NOAA enforcement officers, and of course, National Marine Sanctuaries are under NOAA, so I'm not sure, you know, how they designate those officers at this point in time. You know, are they considered part of NOAA? Are they considered part of the sanctuary administration? That I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But I do know that there are law enforcement officers, but I don't think they're directly associated with the sanctuary.
Right. And but one of the things is they are funded. The sanctuary is funded. It has what's their annual budget? Let's say to take care of these matters, to implement a reporting program and what have you. What do you know about the budget?
Well, the interesting thing about the budget is several people have requested in the past to see the budget figures. Now, we are talking about a federal budget. It's taxpayer money. It's really not supposed to be a secret document. People have requested to see the budget, and no one has received the budget. I happen to know that the budget is $1.5 million a year.
Mm-hmm. And of what amount is spent toward these rulemaking processes? Do you have a breakdown of how it's spent?
No, I do not have a breakdown. I actually haven't seen the budget. I just know the total figure.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know how it's broken down.
Mm-hmm. Now,
I frankly will be doing a Freedom of Information Act request to get that information. You know, obviously people just asking for it, the information has not been forthcoming,
mm-hmm.
but I think if we do a Freedom of Information Act request, obviously they've got to respond.
But it should be just available anyway. I mean, this is all about loving and caring for whales and their well-being and what have you. Why would it be, I mean, we're not asking for the space shuttle's fuel secret. We're just asking what is done with $1.5 million to protect the whales within the sanctuary.
Absolutely. I agree. It should be a transparent situation.
But it's not.
It's not.
Now, you spoke about a meeting that took place a week ago?
Yes, it was March 3rd and 4th, yeah.
Now, you know, as I say, I'm one of those people that you have to tell it twice, but again, this meeting occurred, and was it public meeting? Was it open to the public? Was it who was invited if it was not to the public? Was there special people invited? How did that work?
Well, I learned about this meeting in February, actually, and there was a list of people that was invited to the meeting.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually wanted to go to that meeting because I felt I could contribute something because I am an expert on acoustic impacts, which is another issue that this sanctuary really has to be addressing. So I emailed Naomi McIntosh, the superintendent of the sanctuary, and asked her if I could attend the meeting. She emailed me back. Actually, I had to send her two emails before she replied, and then she did reply and said, no, I could not come. She was very sorry, but there just was not room for me, but that I could, excuse me, that I could come to other meetings, that they would have other public meetings, and I could come to those meetings, but that I could not come. Now, of course, I'm not here all the time,
mm-hmm.
And I really wanted to go to this meeting because I happened to be here. And I also wanted to go because it was the beginning of the first meeting they were having in this process of revising the management plan, and, you know, they were going to set the agenda, obviously, for the rest of the management plan revision, so I thought it was important to get, you know, what I consider to be immediate threats on the agenda, because I also saw the agenda of the meeting, and the agenda did not include the things that are really threatening whales. The agenda items were more kind of nebulous things like forming global partnerships with other sanctuaries in other parts of the world, things like that that, you know, are kind of maybe nice things to think about, but are not addressing the real needs of the whales in this sanctuary.
Global partnership. Why don't they just stay local partnership and be transparent and open it?
Well, that's a good question. And my point has been, before you discuss things like that, you have to discuss the things that are injuring and killing whales, like water quality, ship strikes, and acoustic impacts. So, you know, let's be real and address the immediate threats before we talk about global partnerships.
Mm-hmm.
So I was not allowed to go to the meeting, but I just happened to be talking to someone who works for the sanctuary on another island the day after Naomi emailed me and said I couldn't come because there wasn't enough room. And this person that I was talking to said that the next day, which was a Friday, that she was contacted by people from the sanctuary asking her to recommend some names of people to invite to the meeting because they needed more people. So obviously the reason I wasn't allowed to go was not that there wasn't room. There was some other reason, and I think it was because Naomi knew I was going to mention acoustic impact. She knows that I'm an expert on that issue, and I don't think she wanted to discuss it at the meeting.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is a little shocking because, you know, earlier we year or so, we were talking about the super ferry, and this is not to digress and raise the super ferry, but a lot of people did raise issues that said, well, what about the other vessels and what have you? And now, if what you're saying being true and all, I'm a little shocked that what should have been in place, and we have barges and other vessels traversing the sanctuary on a daily basis, 24/7. And to learn that you're saying now that there are no rules specifically to address those and monitoring and what have you, that's a bit disturbing.
Well, yes, and certainly the ship traffic, because ship traffic, in addition to ship strikes, does create acoustic pollution wherever it is.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, in the oceans as a whole, it is the leading cause of noise in the ocean are, you know, very large container ships.
Mm-hmm.
The three major sources of noise in the ocean are shipping, military high-intensity military sonars, and air guns used for oil and gas exploration.
Mm-hmm.
And two of those things are concerns in the Hawaiian Humpback Whale Sanctuary: the noise from ships and boats, and the noise from high-intensity military sonar. Because I don't know how many people know this, but a part of the sanctuary, a small part, but part of the sanctuary overlaps with the Hawaii Range Complex, which is the area that the Navy uses for military exercises, sonar exercises, and other types of exercises. So there is always the possibility of, you know, high-intensity sonar impacts on all marine life in this sanctuary. And even if sonar exercises are being done outside the sanctuary, noise travels five times faster in water than it does in air, and of course it's going to travel into the sanctuary.
Mm-hmm.
Mid-frequency active sonar can seriously impact whales 40, 50 miles away, which is what happened several years ago in the Hanalei Bay incident that some of your listeners may remember, when there was a whole series of sonar exercises, military exercises, war games, literally going on around the Hawaiian Islands called RIMPAC.
Mm-hmm.
That happens every other year around the Hawaiian Islands with about, anywhere from 7 to 10 different countries participating. And during that exercise several years ago, the mid-frequency sonar caused a large pod of melon-headed whales to swim very rapidly into Hanalei Bay, and they were in there for a very long period of time because it kind of shielded them a bit from the noise of the sonar.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a well-documented instance. It's called a live stranding, when whales are, you know, pushed out of where they are naturally in the ocean and, you know, held, in a sense, captive by a wall of sound.
Mm-hmm.
In the bay. One whale actually did die during that incident. So there have been acoustic impacts, you know, around Hawaii, and this should be discussed by this sanctuary.
Right. Well, again, for my listeners, 524-1080, 524-1080. You can pick this up also at podcast at carolcox.com, carolcox.com, and we have some pictures of whales and whatever if you're interested in a few stories. And my guest is Dr. Marsha Green, who's been dealing with the whale sanctuary and whales for a while, many years here in Hawaii. But speaking of the sounds and the impacts that they have, one of the things is that in the acoustics, the SIRTAS that they have, that's an acronym for told or raised surface sounds or sonic, whatever, I don't have it in front of me, but one of the problems is when they calibrate, you know, they say, well, we're using it at safe decibels. The problem arises when they calibrate the transmitters. That's one of the greatest threats, you know. And, yes, you're right. We did some research. There was a calf, and I actually witnessed, while they were calibrating it on the Big Island, a mother and a calf came into Hanama Bay here on Oahu to get out of it, and she was frantic. I mean, she jumped, breached more than 5 or 6 times, you know.
Well, that's interesting, Carol, because that testing if you're talking about the CERTAS LFA testing that they did on humpback whales off the Big Island in March of 1998, mm-hmm. that's when, yes, they came to test the effects of different levels of sonar, you know, different noise levels of sonar on the humpback whales. The Ocean Mammal Institute actually filed a lawsuit in 1998 to try to stop that testing on the humpback whales off the Big Island. We were trying to get a court restraining order to stop it. We were not able to do that in time, but I did send researchers over to the Big Island to observe the whales during that testing. And one of the things we observed in the very beginning of the month was a calf without its mother. And this poor calf was frantic. As you said, you saw a frantic whale at that time as well. The calf was absolutely frantic. It peck flapped something like 670 times, mm-hmm. you know, tail flapped hundreds of times, breached hundreds of times. And finally, it was dark and we couldn't even follow the calf anymore. But a calf without its mother, of course, is not going to survive. And we found three calves that were separated from their mothers during that one-month period in the sonar testing area. I had never before seen a calf separated from its mother from all the research I did starting in 1986. Separated calves are very rare. And during that one-month testing period, there were three separated calves. And I think that one thing that that sonar does is it, you know, it scares the whales so much that they become separated and they can't find each other. We know that sonar scares whales because there have been several strandings involving beaked whales, and we now know that the noise scares them so much that they come up to the surface too rapidly. Normally they come up and stop and, you know, acclimate and get adjusted to the change in pressure.
Right.
But when they get really scared by the sonar, they come up immediately and they get the bends.
Right.
And that's one of the things that kills whales.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the ways that sonar kills whales.
Okay. Well, we got a caller here with the question. Jay, are you there?
Hey, good morning, Carol, and good morning to your guests.
Good morning.
My question is, I know earlier you talked about not having any rules specific to the whale sanctuary. I'm just wondering what you and your caller thinks or how the Marine Mammal Protection Act and the Endangered Species Act is applied to the sanctuary. I'm kind of curious. I always thought that those types of federal laws would apply, but this is really interesting that there are no specific rules to the sanctuary. So just wondering what your opinion is on that, and I'll take your response off the air. Thank you.
Thank you. Marcia, I'll let you.
Sure. The NMPA and the Endangered Species Act are, you know, wonderful federal laws that have been in place for, what, about 30, 40 years. So those laws apply, yes, they apply to the sanctuary. They apply everywhere. In U.S. waters and even to U.S. citizens outside of U.S. waters, as I understand it. So they're, you know, leading laws, leading environmental laws globally, absolutely wonderful. And they do apply in the sanctuary, of course, but they apply everywhere else. They don't, you know, they existed long before the sanctuary existed. Everybody's so happy that those laws exist. That's what allows, you know, various environmental organizations to file lawsuits, for example. You know, we can file a lawsuit saying, you know, you are violating the Marine Mammal Protection Act or you are violating the Endangered Species Act.
The Marine Mammal Protection Act is a good law, but here's some of the things. There's two things going on here. We need good enforcement, but to get good enforcement, and then when you take a sanctuary, and you are saying, and we've showing that the sanctuary does not have specific rules to the sanctuary, that is the integral part of enforcing the Marine Mammal Protection Act, because whatever violations or what have you that comes will be inevitably filed under the Marine Mammal Protection Act or the Endangered Species Act. But if management in the sanctuary does not have those rules in place or policies or reporting, then the integrity of the entire management system is compromised. So even if we have a law and have 1,000 agents poised to jump out there, jump from planes and get on the boats for hitting whales or doing something illegal, it requires the management to notify them or have a protocol in notifying them. And what Dr. Green is saying, these things are not in place.
Right. was stated very well, Carol. You're right. There has to be, especially in a sanctuary, some way of regulating so that people are obeying the law. I think that's a very good point. And as I said earlier, other sanctuaries do have those kinds of rules and regulations. So it's not that sanctuaries, you know, don't have rules and regulations.
Mm-hmm.
Stellwagen Bank has speed limits. Glacier Bay National Park has speed limits. There are other kinds of, you know, regulations in sanctuaries that really this sanctuary should be talking about during the revision of the management plan.
Mm-hmm. But now the management plan, that the revision of it, so there exists a management plan, earlier one?
Yes, of course they do.
And
they
have to do them how many years?
They're supposed to do it every 5 years.
So now it's been in existence since 1992. The sanctuary has. How many management plans have been submitted that you know of?
Well, to tell you the truth, I don't know how many they've done since the sanctuary started. I know the last management plan, that it last was revised in 2002.
Okay.
So they're a little bit over the five-year limit. You know, it's been a little longer than 5 years.
So
the last one came out in 2002.
So we can just stop right there, and based on that, we know their level of importance. They have assigned the management of the sanctuary, and in that, the management plan would probably cover some of the naval and military maneuvers and activities and RIMPAC and what have you. But not having one in place, then it's a free-for-all out there, it sounds like, in the sanctuary for the Navy and other entities that want to experiment or run vessels that, there's research on hulls and hull designs that are occurring here in the state through Navitech and LBC and what have you.
Well, it's not that the sanctuary doesn't have a management plan. They do have one that they came out, you know, the last revision was in 2002. So they do have a management plan. However, the revision is overdue, and the management plan does not include any rules or regulations to protect whales,
right,
or enforce the Marine Mammal Protection Act or the Endangered Species Act, because humpback whales, as you know, are an endangered species.
Right.
Now, when people have asked Naomi, why is the revision of the management plan, you know, several years overdue, she was quoted in the Maui News a little over a week ago as saying, well, we just didn't have the money to do it. So, of course, the question that I think citizens have to ask is, well, with the $1.5 million budget a year, what are you spending the money on that you say you don't have enough money to, you know, obey this policy that you're supposed to revise the management plan every 5 years?
Mm-hmm. Well, that, to me, this might sound nonsensical, but a three-year delay or tardiness in a management plan, it's like having an 18-year-old can of coffee that's been sitting open. You can say, I got coffee, but is it fresh? Is it going to give you that morning wake-up? Well, just the management plan, there are things that are occurring. In 3 years, we've had Super Ferry. We've had businesses and coming and going that want to have water-based recreation activities. So it's important that you're timely. And they may have one in the past, but the timeliness of it is critical, right?
Absolutely, of course. And as we said, these immediate threats happen, you know, on a daily basis to humpback whales in the sanctuary, the ship strikes, acoustic impacts, the water quality, and, you know, it hasn't been discussed.
Right.
It literally has not been discussed.
So, in other words, don't make us do our job. Anyway, I have another... she hung up, I guess, had a caller wanting to have a comment. But this is something that when we overlay this, there's a lot of whale watching activities going on. There's a lot of water-based recreation being proposed and increased. And a lot of this is around the sanctuary. Now, for example, why I believe the management plan just being a year tardy is bad. And let's talk about the sewage problem. Each island has a main population of city. And what do they generate? As you spoke earlier, the volume of waste that is dumped in there. How much of this is going into the sanctuary? Can you comment on that?
Well, Well, I can't say for sure exactly how much is going into the sanctuary because, you know, waste floats around, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm certainly not an expert on this issue. As I said, I am an expert on acoustic impact, but I'm not an expert on water quality, but I am in contact with scientists here in Maui that are working on this issue.
Mm-hmm.
And what I have learned is that, as I said earlier, the Whale Sanctuary Act that created this sanctuary says there is to be no disposal of waste in sanctuary waters.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a scientist who works on this issue has told me that, you know, Maui County has kind of changed its stand on what goes on in sanctuary waters as time goes by. There's one designation of water quality standards called AA, which is the highest protection, which is, you know, no waste at all. And then there's another level, just A, which allows mixing zones for industrial and other waste, you know, so that there can be some waste dumped into some areas. And the final, you know, there's been some waffling on how to classify the sanctuary, evidently, but the final report, she said, does not say whether whale sanctuary waters are classified as double A or single A. So I guess they really, you know, even though the Sanctuary Act says no disposal of waste in sanctuary waters, the whoever is issuing these reports, you know, doesn't make a designation. They don't make a decision
mm-hmm.
as to what's really happening in the waters. Although she is a scientist and she said science, and there are several published articles on this, has shown that effluents are reaching the ocean and that there are going to have to be water quality controls because it's not in good shape at all.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing I want to say about that issue, that I just talked to her the other day, she came here and started testing the water. And she's the person who found, you know, how bad it really is around Maui. And she said that it was the Surfrider Foundation that initially bought the supplies to test the water quality, which I thought was so interesting, that the Surfrider Foundation, you know, a private organization, bought the supplies to test the water quality. Now, it seems to me, under the Whale Sanctuary Act, since it says no disposal of waste in sanctuary waters, wouldn't the sanctuary be supplying what they need to test, you know, water quality in sanctuary waters?
Not if I wanted to protect the cities and not want to get into their dandruff and cause them, quote, problems. I would do exactly what they're doing. Just sit back and if nobody complains about it or, you know, if they want to spend their own money, why, go ahead. But we're not going to do it because it makes trouble. Our job is to protect the sanctuary.
Yeah, well, I just
I'm being facetious.
Yeah, no, I know. But I was just so shocked when she said the Surfrider Foundation bought the supplies to test the water quality. I mean, it's just an amazing thing. It was an amazing thing to me.
Like the Cheshire Cat, just happy that I would be embarrassed to report that when I have $1,500,000 in the bank account and I can't get a management plan timely. I can't, I have meetings that I spend $30,000 on and only invited guests, but yet it's a public matter being open to the public, but only certain people from the public is invited. I say I smell a rat, and I don't know what size of a rat, but something's wrong here. So what's the plan, action plan to address this? Are you suggesting the public write and inquire of Miss McIntosh's supervisor, or what do we do to get from this place to see if we can improve and be more efficient at the sanctuary?
Okay, there are several things I would suggest. We already have a group in place, which is called Honk Maui, the Hawaii Ocean Noise Coalition, that's been working on the acoustic issue. And let me give you the email of that group. You can email them if you really want to get involved. And we want to obviously involve all of the islands. This happens to be called Honk Maui because that's where I do my whale research from, so I'm usually on Maui. So the email is honkmaui@aol.com. So you can email that address to get involved, to get more information. And I would also suggest emailing Naomi McIntosh with your thoughts on this, urging her to pay attention to these serious issues that are impacting whales currently. But it's also critical that you carbon copy Alan Thom. And I would also suggest carbon copying Dan Basta, who is the director of the Office of National Marine Sanctuaries in Washington, D.C. Their emails are easy. They're all very similar. Naomi McIntosh is naomi.mcintosh, M-C-I-N-T-O-S-H, at NOAA, N-O-N-A, .gov. Alan Thom is Alan, A-L-L-E-N, dot Thom, T-O-M, at NOAA.gov. And their boss is Dan, D-A-N, dot Basta, B-A-S-T-A, at NOAA.gov. I would send the same email to all of them. You know, send it to Naomi, carbon copy Alan and Dan, so everybody knows what's going on.
Now, is there any other points that you'd like to stress here? Because we got about 8 minutes left, actually about 6 minutes. But anything that we did not cover or you'd like to speak to?
Well, I think at this point the important thing is to, I think the only way this is going to change is by a concerted effort from the public, and that's the way things usually change.
Mm-hmm.
So it's important that people get involved. I know everybody's incredibly busy. I'm incredibly busy. Everybody is. But if we don't do something, nothing is going to happen to protect these whales.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's important that Hawaiians become involved in this issue. I know Hawaiians and other people have been very concerned about the way whales are treated when they're injured or when they strand, and sometimes they're just, you know, cut up and carted off in a truck and dumped in a landfill somewhere. Hawaiians would, of course, rather see them return to the ocean, return to their home, treated respectfully. I think this is certainly something that also needs to be discussed, you know, during this plan revision process.
Mm-hmm.
So I would encourage Hawaiians, I would encourage everyone to email honkmaui at AOL.com and get involved. We are going to be working on these issues and coming up with specific things that we think the sanctuary should be doing, and then we're going to request a meeting with Alan and Dan Basta and Naomi. Literally have a face-to-face meeting. They will be having public scoping meetings, which they are required to do under federal law as they revise this plan, and I would encourage people to go to the public scoping meetings. I've been to many in my life, mostly involving acoustic and sonar issues. I find they are not the most effective way of getting things done, but I think you still have to go and show up and, you know, say something or give them a little written note. But I think we need a face-to-face meeting with Naomi and Alan and Dan Basta. And we go in prepared with what we want to happen. And, we, you know, we have the press alerted, that kind of thing. It's the only way I can think of getting something done.
Now, how do the people contact you if they had questions specifically for you?
They can email honkmaui at AOL.com.
And they'll be able to just address it to you specifically?
Yes, and they can also go to my website, which is Ocean Mammal Institute. It's Ocean Mammal Inst, I-N-S-T. .org, or if you just type in Ocean Mammal Institute into Google, the website will come up, and you can email me from my website as well. Ocean Mammal Institute.
Okay.
O-M-I, OMI. You can email me from the website there, or at Honk Maui.
And you'll be here for a while. When do you go back to the coast?
Well, I'm scheduled to go back Wednesday. That might change a little bit. But I certainly will be coming back periodically to work on this and to go to various meetings. So I'll certainly be coming back. I've been here since 1986, and I'll be coming back.
Will you be able to share any updates with us if you've come up with anything?
Oh, absolutely, Carol. I appreciate you very much having me on your show so that people can learn about what's going on, you know, in their own sanctuary.
Right, and this show is for the whales. Sometimes it's for the birds, but this is for the whales.
It's for all life, right?
Right, but they are absolutely magnificent, the animals. And the nice part about it, they do more for our economy than our politicians do, believe it or not. When you go to Lanai Lookout and you see the crowds of people gazing out over the ocean, waiting to see that single blow. They're happy. So I want to thank you for calling in and talking with me and joining me on the show. And if there's anything new development, please don't hesitate to call me. And I appreciate your time.
Thank you very much, Carol.
Aloha.
Aloha.
Well, that's going to wrap it up today. But we'll be talking again, and all these nice things and interesting things. And we should expect a lot from the people because we pay them. They take our money, and it's not a great demand. Global Entrepreneur with Tina Kazon is coming up next. And thank you for joining me. Aloha.
Sailing down my dirty stream of chewing gum, dropped by some hikers to warn of things to come. At Glens Falls, 5,000 honest hands work at the consolidated paper plant. 5 million gallons of waste a day. Why should we do it any other way? Down the valley, 1 million toilet chains find my Hudson so convenient place to drain. And each little city says, who, me? Do you think that sewage plants come free? Out in the ocean, they say the water's clear. But I live right at Beacon here. Halfway between the mountains and the sea, tacking to and fro, this thought returns to me. Will it sailing up my dirty stream? That someday, though maybe not this year, my Hudson River and my country will run clear.
Listening, and tune in again next time for the Carol Cox Show on K108.